Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We pull the most complex narratives apart, distilling them into the essential truths and fascinating insights you need to be well-informed.
And today, we're wading into a career that is really defined by volatility.
Absolutely. A trajectory that's just marked by extremes. You've got massive commercial highs, you've got fierce artistic independence, and then, of course, profound personal turmoil and these incredibly public legal battles.
We are covering the life and, I think, very complex career of John Christopher Depp II. He's an actor, a musician, a painter. And his path is just unlike almost any other A-lister in modern Hollywood.
It really is a unique story.
It is. And what we have here is a genuinely comprehensive stack of sources. I mean, this is a deep chronological look at his entire life. It covers his filmography, his art, his legal history.
And the massive shifts in his public image.
Exactly. It's more than just a biography. It's kind of a map of how an artistic identity is manufactured, celebrated, and then ultimately scrutinized in our modern media landscape.
So our mission statement for today is precisely that. We want to trace this complex narrative of his transformation.
Right.
From a high school dropout rock musician into a global superstar, and then really analyze the artistic choices that define that unique persona and the dramatic fluctuations of his career that followed, right up to his recent return to things like directing and painting.
And the initial hook, I think. The central irony that just permeates everything we're about to talk about is so simple.
What's that?
The man who became one of the highest paid actors in the world, whose films have grossed, what, over $10 billion globally?
Incredible.
He only pursued acting in the first place to pay the bills for his true passion.
Which was music.
He was, and he said this himself, an accidental actor who was just sort of thrust into stardom.
Okay, let's unpack this journey then, starting right at the beginning, seeing how that musician identity was really forged.
Well, he was born June 9, 1963, in Owensboro, Kentucky. He was the youngest of four children.
And his childhood was marked by intense instability, right? The sources say the family moved frequently.
All the time. Reportedly something like 20 times before they finally settled down in Miramar, Florida, around 1970.
That kind of constant movement, you often see that in artists who later, you know, seek escape or transformation through their work.
It's a classic pattern. And that family upheaval, it really culminated when his parents divorced in 1978. He was just 15.
That's a hugely formative age for something that disruptive.
Absolutely. But it is worth noting that his mother, Betty Sue, she later remarried a man named Robert Palmer, who Depp publicly called an inspiration. So even in all that turmoil, there were these positive grounding influences.
But the true grounding element seems to have been music.
Well, without a doubt. He got a guitar when he was 12 years old, and that instrument just immediately focused his entire trajectory.
To the point where he dropped out of Miramar High School at 16.
In 1979, yeah. Specifically to chase this dream of becoming a rock musician.
And here's a detail that feels like it's straight out of a movie script. His high school principal apparently encouraged him to do it.
Right. Reportedly told him that if he could fulfill his dream, he shouldn't stop. I mean, that's such a rare endorsement from an academic authority figure. It's like it validated his choice to pursue art over a traditional path.
So he just throws himself into the rock scene.
Completely. He's playing in all these different bands, including one called The Kids, which formed in 1980. They had some local success in Florida, and then they made the pilgrimage that, you know, every hopeful band makes.
They moved to L.A.
Moved to Los Angeles, hoping to get a record deal. They even renamed themselves Six Gun Method.
And that L.A. hustle was real for him. He had to take on odd jobs while trying to make it.
Yeah, the sources mentioned all sorts of things. I think one of them was telemarketing, which is just a universe away from the red carpets that were waiting for him. He was living that classic struggling artist life.
And the major career pivot, the moment everything changes, it comes through his first marriage.
Exactly. In December 1983, he marries Lorianne Allison. She's a makeup artist and also the sister of his band's bassist. And through her industry connections, he gets introduced to Nicolas Cage.
This is the moment. This is where fate just steps in.
It is. Cage and Depp became drinking buddies. And Cage apparently saw this raw, intense energy in him. And he gave him this really straightforward, pragmatic advice.
He told him to try acting.
But not for art. Purely as a temporary means to an end. Specifically to cover the unpaid bills that his music career was racking up.
So wait, the sources are explicit about this. Cage just saw acting as a way for his friend to make some quick cash.
Absolutely. Depp himself was crystal clear on it. He said he had, quote, no desire to be an actor and that he ended up acting by accident.
Yeah.
It was a financial decision, nothing more.
And yet, despite having zero acting experience,
Iroh.
He lands his first feature film role almost instantly. A Nightmare on Elm Street in 1984.
And the anecdote is just fantastic.
Yeah.
He was chosen partly because the director, Wes Craven, his daughter, thought Depp was handsome.
So it wasn't about his training. It was just pure star quality, a gut feeling.
It's a literal accident of fate that created a global star.
Hmm.
And even though his band, The Kids, split up before they could get that record deal, he kept his musical identity alive. He co-wrote a song called Mary for a band called Rock City Angels.
And by 1985, he and Allison had divorced, but that path towards acting was now, you know, irreversibly set. He was a working actor, whether he liked it or not.
Which brings us to the mid to late 80s, and he just runs headlong into this identity crisis that's going to shape the entire next decade of his career.
The teen idol struggle.
The teen idol struggle. He gets cast as this young undercover cop, Tom Hansen, in the TV series 21 Jump Street. It premiered in 1987. And it just instantly brought him this massive and very unwanted prominence.
The show made him a heartthrob, like a certified Tiger Beat cover boy.
Exactly. But that success, which was precisely what Cage had told him to go get for financial stability, it came at this huge artistic and personal cost.
He was miserable.
Deeply unhappy. He said the series forced him into the role of product. He was being marketed as a pretty face, and he despised it.
What's fascinating here, though, is how he deliberately uses that dissatisfaction. He leverages it into a calculated artistic strategy.
Yes, his disillusionment with the whole teen idol thing led him to actively seek out unconventional, non-commercial, sometimes just downright strange roles that he found more interesting.
He was intentionally sabotaging his own conventional leading man career before it could even get started.
It was the birth of his anti-idol persona. Film scholar Anna Everett wrote about how his 90s image was seen as gender-bending, actively subverting what you'd expect from a typical Hollywood male star.
He became part of that famous holy trinity of grunge heartthrobs, right? Him, River Phoenix, and Keanu Reeves.
The guys who seemed almost embarrassed by their own looks and preferred to hide them behind character and costume.
So he was actively fighting the system. He wanted to be a character actor, but he was trapped in a leading man's body.
Precisely. And this whole calculated rebellion was instantly cemented by his first and maybe most defining collaboration.
With Tim Burton, Edward Scissorhands, in 1990.
A critical and commercial success and the start of an 8-film partnership. It was just the perfect vehicle for his desire to escape his own face.
And the preparation he did for that role really shows his commitment to the craft over fame. The sources say he studied Charlie Chaplin films.
Right, to learn how to generate sympathy without dialogue, using just movement and silence.
Success was massive. He got his first Golden Globe nomination. But let's pause on the weirdest bit of recognition he got.
Well, you have to mention this.
An extinct arthropod species with prominent claws.
Cutinic Jellideff.
Was named after him. That is the ultimate confirmation of an iconic performance, a permanent scientific tribute to Edward Scissors.
It absolutely is. And he kept that streak going through the early 90s, proving his artistic choices weren't just a fluke.
We see it with Benny and June in 1993, where he played an eccentric, silent film fan. It was a sleeper hit, got him his second Golden Globe nomination.
And critics explicitly compared his physical, you know, idiosyncratic performance to masters like Buster Keaton. It showed he excelled at that nonverbal communication.
And 1993 also gave us What's Eating Gilbert Grape, where he's working opposite a very young Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah, and while DiCaprio was getting all the awards buzz, critics didn't overlook Depp. They praised his greatly affable, appealing characterization as the grounded, struggling older brother.
This whole decade, this rejection of the mainstream path, it really hits a high point with Ed Wood in 1994.
Which is funny because he was reportedly pretty depressed about filmmaking at the time, feeling a bit lost. But he took the role of the infamous, most inept film director in history almost immediately.
And he later said that the role and working with Martin Landau completely rejuvenated his love for acting.
What a statement, right? Playing the worst director ever saved his relationship with his craft, and it earned him his third Golden Globe nomination, cementing his status as this critical darling who just happened to hate commercial films.
But his range wasn't just limited to being quirky. He took a really serious, gritty turn with Donnie Brasco in 97.
Opposite Al Pacino. Based on the true story of an undercover FBI agent infiltrating the mafia, He apparently spent a ton of time with the real Joseph D. Pistone to prepare.
And that performance is widely considered one of his absolute finest. It proved he could do serious, dramatic work outside of the whole Burton universe.
He was also exploring the limits of his own creative control around then. In 1997, he made his directorial debut with The Brave.
He also co-wrote and starred in it, playing a poor Native American man who sells himself to be in a snuff film. I mean, that is a dark, controversial concept.
And the outcome was tough. It got pretty negative reviews. Variety called it a turgid and unbelievable neo-Western. Yeah, the reaction was so poor that Depp himself chose not to release it in the U.S.
Yeah.
That had to be a crushing blow.
The theme of artistic rebellion, though, continued really strongly with his connection to Hunter S. Thompson.
That connection is just vital to understanding his whole persona, the Gonzo ethos. He played Roll Duke in Terry Gilliam's Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas in 1998.
So for anyone listening who isn't familiar, Gonzo is a type of journalism popularized by Thompson that's like deeply subjective, immersive.
And often chemically fueled.
Yeah.
It blurs the line between the reporter and the participant completely.
So playing Thompson's alter ego was this profound act of both friendship and art for him.
They were incredibly close. The sources detail how Depp accompanied Thompson as his road manager on one of the author's last book tours.
And then famously, after Thompson's suicide in 2005, Depp paid for most of that elaborate memorial where Thompson's ashes were shot out of a cannon.
That level of dedication to the Gonzo spirit, that commitment to living on the fringes, it really cemented his artistic outsider status as we headed into the new millennium.
He closed out the 90s by rejoining Burton for Sleepy Hollow in 1999. Which was a big commercial and critical hit.
And again, he focused on obscuring the traditional leading man, taking inspiration from Angela Lansbury and silent era stars to make Ichabod Crane this delicate, fragile person who was maybe a little too in touch with his feminine side.
So as the decade turns, his personal life seems to enter a period of stability. He ends that high-profile relationship with Kate Moss and starts a 14-year partnership with French actress Vanessa Paradis in 1998.
And they have two children, Lily Rose in 99 and Jack in 2002.
This personal anchor seems really crucial here. He said that having children gave him a real foundation, a real strong place to stand in life, in work, in everything. He called fatherhood destiny.
And that stability comes just as his career is about to be pulled, maybe a bit reluctantly, into the massive commercial world he spent a decade rejecting.
That tension, the independent artist versus the Hollywood machine, it really reaches a breaking point here.
It does. His previous agent, Tracy Jacobs, had apparently taken a lot of heat over the years from executives just constantly asking,
when is he finally going to do a blockbuster?
Exactly. When is this guy going to make us some real money?
And the answer arrived in the most unexpected way possible in 2003. This is the moment he just fundamentally redefines his career, maybe even accidentally betrays his whole 90s ethos.
Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl. This film brings him true worldwide stardom. It makes him one of the biggest box office draws on the planet.
It was the blockbuster they wanted, but delivered in a way nobody could have possibly expected.
The story about Captain Jack Sparrow's inspiration, Keith Richards and Pepe Le Pew. It seems impossible.
So how did he fuse those two?
Well, the sources emphasize the duality. Keith Richards gave him that staggering walk, the rock and roll swagger, the sort of slurred, knowing demeanor.
Okay, I see that.
But Pepe Le Pew provided the slightly effete, cartoonish, almost flustered, non-threatening physical comedy.
So the combination let him create a character so outlandish that he could be in this massive tentpole movie, but still hide the leading man behind a mask of stylized weirdness.
Which fit his 90s mandate perfectly.
And the studio's reaction was initially pretty hostile, right?
Oh, highly ambivalent.
Yeah.
Disney executives were reportedly very concerned that the portrayal was too eccentric. Maybe too intoxicated. They were worried about how mass audiences would react.
Yeah.
One executive famously asked, is he gay?
But the audience reaction just overrode all of that. They adored the comic performance.
And that character, Jack Sparrow, earned him an MTV Movie Award, a Screen Actors Guild Award for Best Actor, and his very first Academy Award nomination.
This was really his awards peak. He got 3 Oscar nominations in this decade alone, for Pirates in 03, for playing J.M. Barry in Finding Neverland in 04, and then for Sweeney Todd in 2007.
This era just solidified him as a pop culture titan. Beyond the awards, he was named People's Sexiest Man Alive not once, but twice in 2003 and again in 2009. His films were just monumental.
And the Burton collaborations, they just seamlessly transition into blockbuster territory. You have Charlie and the Chocolate Factory in 2005 as Willy Wonka, earning him another Golden Globe nomination.
Then the voice role in the animation Corpse Bride.
And the pinnacle of their musical work together was Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street in 2007.
A really challenging role. It was the first time he had to sing extensively on film. And his preparation was so characteristic of him, he avoided a professional vocal coach. Instead, he just recorded demos with his old bandmate, Bruce Witkin.
And it paid off. Critics were stunned by his soaring voice, and he won the Golden Globe for Best Musical or Comedy Actor. It showed that even in a highly commercial genre, his deep roots in rock music provided this authentic core.
And in parallel to all this, he's building his own production infrastructure. In 2004, he founds his production company, Infinitum Nihil, with his sister Christy as president.
Which let him keep some control, right? To shepherd projects that were personally meaningful, even while he was swimming in this mainstream ocean.
Exactly. And his ability to pivot between a massive franchise and a really serious historical drama was key to this era. In 2009, he played the real-life gangster John Dillinger in Michael Mann's Public Enemies.
Which was praised for its realism. Roger Ebert noted Depp played Dillinger as a fact, not based on movie portrayals, which just shows that constant commitment to character research.
So the 2010s start at his absolute commercial zenith. Alice in Wonderland in 2010, where he's the Mad Hatter, earns over $1 billion worldwide. It was the second highest grossing film of the year.
He also scored a major critical and commercial hit with the animated film Rango in 2011, voicing the title character.
So by 2012, the numbers just tell the story. Guinness World Records lists him as the world's highest paid actor, pulling in $75 million in a single year.
That is just staggering.
And that enormous income figure is so crucial because it illustrates the scale of the fall that came right after. I mean, if you connect this to the bigger picture, the sheer financial pressure of being the world's highest paid actor meant that when the failure started hitting,
they created seismic shockwaves.
Exactly. A string of high budget commercial failures began in the mid-2010s, and it marked a rapid, dramatic downturn.
We saw box office struggles with Burton's Dark Shadows in 2012, the sci-fi thriller Transcendence in 2014, and then the disastrous Mordecai in 2015.
But the most financially destructive film of this period was The Lone Ranger in 2013.
Oh, that was a calamity for Disney. It resulted in a staggering reported loss of $190 million.
And it's important to note, that film didn't just fail financially. It also faced intense criticism and accusations of whitewashing for his casting as Tonto, the Native American character.
Even though he'd been adopted as an honorary son by LaDonna Harris, a member of the Comanche Nation.
Right, but the controversy compounded the financial disaster.
So even as his commercial career is stumbling, did he manage to maintain his critical standing in smaller, more serious roles?
He did, which is what's so interesting. He showed this remarkable critical resilience, Black Mass, in 2015. Where he played the terrifying Boston crime boss, Whitey Bulger.
Which was incredible.
It was hailed by critics as one of his best performances, earned him another Screen Actors Guild nomination. He proved he could still deliver the goods when he focused on character.
And this pattern continued more recently with Minamata in 2020. He portrayed the war photographer W. Eugene Smith, and reviews called it his best work in years.
Yet, and this is key, the sources suggest its U.S. release was allegedly hampered by studio concerns over his public reputation following the start of his legal troubles.
Now that is a powerful indicator of his shifting status. A critically acclaimed performance being buried by Hollywood suggests that the personal narrative had completely superseded the professional quality of the work.
It had. Which brings us directly to the Fantastic Beasts franchise. He'd played the dark wizard Gellert Grindelwald from 2016 to 2018.
But then following that major setback in the UK libel case in November 2020, he resigns from the franchise at the request of Warner Bros.
The loss of that mainstream role signaled a clear retreat by Hollywood studios. But the next few years show this fascinating duality. While mainstream American studios backed away, he started receiving significant international recognition. He collected multiple honorary awards at prestigious European festivals in 2020 and 2021 in Poland, the Czech Republic, Spain.
And these awards, of course, were highly controversial. They drew immediate criticism from domestic violence charities.
They did. But the festival organizers, like at the San Sebastian Film Festival, they publicly defended their decisions. They said they wouldn't revoke the award because he hadn't been charged by any authority in any jurisdiction or convicted of any form of violence against women.
So Depp himself starts to publicly comment on this shift, characterizing himself as a victim of cancel culture in 2021.
And that narrative was reinforced by continued international accolades, like receiving the Serbian Gold Medal of Merit in 2022 for his cultural activities. The European film scene was clearly embracing him, even as the U.S. kept its distance.
His recent artistic efforts show a really strong return to independent filmmaking.
Absolutely. In 2023, he starred as King Louis XV in the French period film Jean du Barry. It was his first role acting entirely in French. It premiered at Cannes and got a 7-minute standing ovation.
And he's returned to directing for the first time in over 25 years.
Yeah. Modi, 3 Days on the Wing of Madness, which was co-produced by Al Pacino. It premiered at the San Sebastian Film Festival and again was met with this really warm reception and another lengthy standing ovation.
And here's the ultimate twist in all this. Despite everything, as of 2025, there's talk about him possibly returning to the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise.
Right. Producer Jerry Bruckheimer confirmed they've discussed Jack Sparrow's return pending a script. Which just indicates that the character he created, that accidental, idiosyncratic superstar, still holds immense global commercial value, regardless of all the personal turmoil.
It's so crucial to remember that his music career wasn't just some phase for him. It was his initial identity.
It was his whole reason for being in L.A. And he's consistently played guitar, vocals, and bass across different genres his entire life. He often appears uncredited on film soundtracks like for Chuck Lass and Once Upon a Time in Mexico.
And people forget that in the 90s, when he was making his name as the anti-idol, he was also in that rock supergroup, P.
With some heavy hitters. Gibby Haynes of Butthole Surfers, Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers, and Steve Jones of the Sex Pistols. He was truly living a dual life.
And that supergroup theme continued later on. In 2015, he formed the Hollywood Vampires with Alice Cooper and Joe Perry.
Rock legends. And that band has released 2 albums and toured extensively worldwide. They had a major tour in 2023, and it often served as his primary artistic outlet during his most troubled public period.
The music career became especially poignant during the height of his legal battles. In 2020, he released a cover of Isolation with the legendary guitarist Jeff Beck.
And they recorded a joint album after that, 18, which came out in July 2022. That collaboration with Beck was a very visible artistic refuge for him.
He joined Beck on tour across the UK, Europe, and the US in the latter half of 2022, playing concerts just weeks after the high-profile US trial ended.
It demonstrated a really clear pivot back to his roots and away from the demands of traditional Hollywood.
And following Jeff Beck's passing, Depp continued performing tributes. He appeared at the tribute concerts with icons like Eric Clapton and Rod Stewart in 2023.
And just recently, in July 2024, he was a special guest at Andrea Bocelli's 30th anniversary concert, performing a guitar tribute to Beck. The depth of that commitment is just undeniable.
So if music was the first escape, visual art seems to have provided the most recent one.
It seems so. Beyond film and music, Depp has launched this hugely successful third career as a visual artist. In July 2022, his Friends and Heroes collection debuted at a gallery in London.
Featuring portraits of people who inspired him, Al Pacino, Keith Richards, Bob Dylan, Elizabeth Taylor.
And the commercial reception was just instantaneous and massive. The collection sold 780 prints for nearly $4 million in a matter of hours. The gallery officially called it their fastest-selling collection ever.
Wow.
And he sees art as this therapeutic medium, a way to reflect. He was really candid about this when he unveiled a self-portrait called Five in 2023.
What was that about?
He linked it to entering the fifth year of a very dark phase in his life. He talked about how uncomfortable self-portraiture is, but admitted that almost everything he creates is, in his words, a self-portrait in one way or another.
And his commitment to this continued into 2024 when he had his first major art exhibition in New York City titled A Bunch of Stuff. It featured works spanning decades.
Right, proving this wasn't just some new celebrity hobby, but a core part of his private artistic expression that's now being brought into the public sphere.
Okay, we have to turn now to the period of intense personal struggles and the highly publicized legal battles, which, you know, ultimately overshadowed so much of his artistic work.
And we must report on these events and their outcomes neutrally, strictly as the factual verdicts and settlements that came out of the courts.
We should probably start by acknowledging that the behavioral controversies have a long history, dating back to his early career. He was arrested in Vancouver back in 1989 for assaulting a security guard.
And then a few years later, in New York City in 1994, he was arrested for causing significant property damage at the Mark Hotel, which resulted in him having to pay almost $10,000 in damages.
And then another arrest in 1999 for brawling with paparazzi in London. So these incidents established an early public reputation for volatility.
Yes. Then came the dramatic financial troubles that surfaced later on. In 2017, he sued his former management company, TMG, for alleged fraud and gross mismanagement, claiming they left him over $40 million in debt.
And TMG countered immediately, arguing that his own fiscal irresponsibility was the problem.
And they provided some pretty dramatic details about his spending habits. One of the most publicized claims was that he was spending far more than $30,000 a month on fine wine.
So, wait, how did Depp respond to that specific claim?
Well, this is the thing. He disputed the amount, but not the principal. He called the $30,000 figure insulting because, as he explained in court, he had actually spent far more than that.
Wow. I mean, that moment just encapsulates the dramatic scale of the personal wealth and the alleged fiscal disconnect that was happening in his life.
It does. And both that suit and a related one against his lawyers were eventually settled.
We also have to address the long-standing struggle with substance use that was detailed during the court proceedings. He admitted to starting drug use at 11 and having used every kind of drug there were by 14.
And while he claimed in 2013 that he'd stopped drinking, his testimony during the 2020 UK libel trial revealed continued issues. He admitted to being addicted to Roxycodone and to misusing alcohol, though he denied addiction to other substances he admitted using, like cocaine and MDMA.
The most visible struggles, of course, centered on the Amber Heard litigations. They began their relationship while filming The Rum Diary, married in 2015, and divorced in 2017. Heard pledged her $7 million divorce settlement to charity.
And it is so essential here to delineate the key difference between the two major cases because they had very, very different outcomes.
Right. The first was the UK libel case, Depp v. News Group Newspapers, LTD. Depp sued the publishers of The Sun over an article that called him a wife beater.
And the outcome in the UK went against him. In November 2020, the High Court of Justice ruled that the wife beater description was substantially true. The judge explicitly found that 12 of the 14 alleged incidents of physical violence had occurred.
Correct. The judge rejected Depp's claim that Heard's allegations were a hoax, and his appeal was subsequently rejected in March 2021.
And that loss directly led to Warner Bros. Asking him to resign from Fantastic Beasts. That verdict severely damaged his career, especially in the UK and Europe, even if he later found success at the European festivals.
The second, and perhaps more intensely scrutinized case, was the U.S. defamation suit in Virginia.
Depp v. Heard. Depp sued Heard over a 2018 Washington Post op-ed, where Heard described herself as a public figure representing domestic abuse. He alleged this defamed him and damaged his career, even though the op-ed never mentioned him by name.
And Heard then countersued over statements made by Depp's lawyer, Adam Waldman, who called her allegations a hoax.
Exactly. And that trial was televised. It ran from April to June of 2022, and it became this major, major cultural event.
The U.S. verdict, delivered by the jury after 13 hours of deliberation, it was a nuanced one, but it generally favored Depp.
It did. The jury found that all three specific statements from Heard's op-ed were false, defamatory, and made with actual malice. Depp was awarded $10 million in compensatory damages and $5 million in punitive, though that was reduced due to Virginia law.
Totaling about $10.35 million.
But crucially, the jury also considered Heard's countersuit, and they found that one of the three statements made by Depp's lawyer was defamatory, false, and made with actual malice. So Heard was awarded $2 million in compensatory damages.
So it was a complex verdict with liability found on both sides, but the major financial and reputational judgment sided with Depp.
The whole legal saga concluded with a settlement in December 2022, and Depp's lawyers maintained that the jury's decision and the judgment in his favor remained fully in place.
And Depp reacted really powerfully to that verdict, stating that the jury gave me my life back.
He did. And later, in 2025, he reflected on why he had to fight the suit. He said he had to semi-eviscerate himself because if he didn't represent the truth, the fiction being pawned around the fucking globe would mean his children would have to live with it.
Finally, we have to acknowledge his consistent philanthropic efforts, which often run counter to the chaos of his public life. He received the Courage to Care Award from Children's Hospital Los Angeles way back in 2006.
And following the litigation, his charitable focus really seemed to intensify. He donated profits from the sale of his Never Fear Truth NFTs, totaling nearly $800,000, to various organizations, including several children's hospitals.
Moreover, the $1 million settlement he received from Amber Heard was publicly pledged for donation to 5 different charities, including children's hospitals and organizations like the Painted Turtle.
And of course, he is famous globally for making these frequent, unannounced costume visits as Captain Jack Sparrow to children's hospitals all over the world, using his most famous persona for, you know, profound good.
So, to synthesize this extraordinary and really complex journey,
John Christopher Depp II's career is defined by this deliberate artistic resistance in the 90s, where he cultivated the role of the anti-idol.
Then an explosive commercial embrace in the 2000s, where he created an iconic character that let him be a superstar while still hiding his true face.
And then a dramatic public collapse and a forced return to independence in the 2010s and 2020s.
His legacy is just defined equally by record-breaking commercial performance, his films grossing over $10.8 billion worldwide, and the intense personal and legal scrutiny that fundamentally destabilized his position as an A-list actor.
He's a man who was once the highest-paid actor on Earth and is now directing French period films and selling abstract paintings.
He's a star who succeeded by rejecting the system, was temporarily absorbed by it, and was ultimately ejected by it,
forcing him back toward the independent artistic ventures, music directing, painting, that he cultivated decades prior, when he was just trying to pay the bills for his guitar career.
And that leads us to our final provocative thought for you to consider. Depp intentionally rejected the traditional Hollywood leading man role in the 90s, choosing instead to obscure his looks and focus on complex, non-conforming characters.
Mm-hmm.
What does it say about the modern celebrity machine and our information age that his career was ultimately derailed not by poor box office choices, which were certainly present, but almost entirely by public scrutiny of his personal life?
It's a huge question.
Is the role of the non-conforming, unconventional, high-value A-list actor truly obsolete for anyone who doesn't conform to an image of perceived perfection in today's intense media environment? If an actor who successfully resisted the mold for decades can be so swiftly cast out based on personal turmoil, does this signal a dangerous homogenization for future generations of Hollywood stars?
We hope this deep dive gave you the necessary context to understand this truly unique career and all the forces that shaped it.
Thanks for diving deep with us. We'll see you next time.